Welcome to the ODI Monthly Podcast, bringing you the views on the news from the Overseas Development Institute. I'm Jonathan Tanner, and this month we take a closer look at life in one of the world's biggest refugee camps, explore the reality of delivering aid in Somalia during the 2011 famine, and probe the relationship between organised crime and democracy. These sounds could come from any high street in the Middle East. People going about their shopping, traffic rumbling by, and television sets blaring out music. In fact, they come from one of the world's largest refugee camps. Zaatari, perched on the Jordanian border with Syria, has been a temporary home to over 250,000 Syrians who have fled the conflict in their own country. Previously a piece of barren desert, in just 18 months, it has become home to nearly 100,000 people. Thanks to a pioneering social media project, followers of the Zaatari camp Twitter feed have been given a unique insight into life in the camp. A series of day-in-the-life videos have revealed in great detail the reality of problems facing refugees and those who are trying to help them. But most importantly, they have helped to lift the lid on the fact that to be a refugee is not to become an abstract concept, but to be a normal human being in highly abnormal circumstances. Using Skype, I was able to speak to 24-year-old Rahaf, a Syrian student who was in the fourth year of her engineering degree when she left the country, and camp manager Killian Kleinschmidt about their experiences over the last 12 months. I began by asking Rahaf to describe her average day in Zaatari.
I wake up every day at sometimes half past 7, sometimes 8 o'clock, sometimes at 9. I drink my coffee with sugar and no milk. Sometimes I eat my breakfast, then I go to work while I'm talking to my fiancé on the phone. And the work takes maybe 15 minutes. I'm working in the women's center. I'm teaching English. And sometimes I help with another activities like mosaic painting. There was a British woman who was teaching us making mosaic painting. And sometimes I drawing and some activities like this.
Rahaf's job has meant her family has a better living environment than some.
I live in 3 caravans. We have a little space between the caravans. At first, we had just 1 caravan. Then after that, we buy 2 another caravans. Me and my 2 sisters live in one. My 2 brothers live in the other one. The last one, my parents can sleep in it. So we have a little space outside, but this is one house of the houses in the camp. Not all the houses like this, because my mother is working as a teacher. My brother work in the Save the Children, and me also we can make this house and buy caravans. We make a small kitchen, a small bathroom, but another people can't do that.
With so many people there, the camp has a lot going on.
There are a lot of shops in Zaatari camp for food, for shoes, for clothes, and for everything, I think. There are hospitals, women's centers like that I work in. My favorite shop is, I think, for clothes and shoes.
Regular listeners will remember a piece earlier this year where we discussed the reasons why many refugees try to live in cities as opposed to camps. After some time in Zaatari, Rahaf became one of them.
I trying to leave to Amman because I want to continue my education. We and my sister and brother. But when we go outside the camp, they told us that they want the grades from Damascus. So we should come back to Syria, and this is impossible. Spend about 4 months, then we come back because we can't continue. And when I was in Amman, I worked with the Syrian Women Association as a teacher for kids.
Having returned, Rahaf is currently happier in Zaatari.
Very happy because I want to stay with my mom and my father. Life here is better than outside because it's with my family.
All of the residents of the camp are under the watch of Killian Kleinschmidt, sometimes known as the mayor of Zaatari. I asked Killian what progress he felt he had made since his arrival.
I have been here for 9 months, and I can say that when I came, it was cold, and now it's cold again. So there's somehow a circle closing. And I would have liked to see more development of the camp happening in that period. I mean, the simple conditions of the streets themselves, the sort of the ground becomes very muddy when it is wet, and it's sort of a grim environment during the winter. So the challenge we are all facing is that, well, we have managed to provide most people with caravans, as they call them. These are these trailers, basically living containers, which are donated by many countries, primarily from the region, from the Gulf and other Arab countries. But there's still 3,000 families today living in tents. And I find it very unfortunate to walk around to the camp and see that they're still there. Although there were promises made by some of those donating them that it would be possible to give everyone a caravan before the end of this summer. This has not happened. It's not a good feeling to see that some people are starting even their second winter now in a tent. So that is an unpleasant part. And it's also important to see, well, we have more normal daily activities now taking place. Of course, we would like to see more of this. We would like to see more social activities taking place, although there are a lot. There are schools, there's the playgrounds. You see, the playgrounds are more busy today than they used to be before. There are more of them also.
The camp's population has recently fallen. Asked about why people might want to leave Zaatari, Killian understands their motives, but suggests the onset of winter may drive numbers back up.
Zaatari has experienced over 370,000 people coming through the camp since it was created in July 2012. There's a lot of people. Out of that number, only 80,000 or so are in the camp today. Many, many have made that choice to go to the villages and cities of Jordan and try their luck, of course, linked quite often to income opportunities, but also the dignity to be free and to be on your own and continue with education and continue with other social activities, which are more difficult in a place which was very messy till a few months ago, such as Zaatari. So people have made the choice to go to the cities. Others made the choice to go back to Syria. About 50,000 people returned from Jordan, not only from the camp. And so there has been this movement out of the camp. But we're seeing today people coming back to the camp. Maybe because it has become more settled, more quiet, there's less violence than there used to be, and the community begins to find each other. I have the feeling, I may be wrong. There is also, of course, the fact that the winter is coming, the jobs are more difficult to find in construction and in agriculture outside of the camp, and so people are coming back. We're seeing again an increase for the winter.
One of the most surprising things you learn from watching the Day in the Life videos is the extent of the economy in Zaatari, with over $12 million worth of dinar changing hands over the course of a month. However, even here, inequality is a contemporary challenge.
There's a massive economy, but of course it creates problems because some people have money, some other people don't have money. Some people have work, many people don't have work. We think that about 60% of the people have some form of revenue, but very many times it's money people sending from abroad. There's lots of people working in the Gulf, but of course there's also family in Europe, in America, somewhere else. So money is coming in, but there's still a lot of families without an income. And one of the big problems here in the camp is that so many households are actually female-headed. Women are heading the household because the men are not here. That also brings many of the children to work. And so that's one of the concerns.
So how well are people's needs being met?
Of course, everyone in the camp receives a basic assistance from the various humanitarian organizations, but which should allow you to survive. But survival is not good enough. I think we have to recognize that people have to start living and building up for their future again. And so many, many people want, of course, also to have a better information. So, well, we have had issues with everybody connecting to electricity, for instance. Electricity is available, but it's an illegal connection as such for the moment. So people want to connect and they want to buy a TV because they want information. They're keen on to know what's going on back home. 40% of the households today have access to a TV. But again, you need to buy the TV. We're not distributing TVs. So it's very difficult at times to, on one hand, ensure survival of people, and then, of course, being able to invest in their future and recognizing that people are different. Some people have education already. They need to be able to continue with higher studies. And it's very important that we would go to for secondary education and even higher studies for people here in the camp as well. I'm very, very impatient because we shouldn't be wasting time on things which are self-evident. What is a very important aspect now for the camp is that we have all realized that this conflict is not going away so fast. So people will have to stay, unfortunately, for longer in exile and have to stay probably in this camp for some time longer. So we need to make sure that the systems we put up are more cost-effective, run in a more sustainable manner. So instead of tankering water into the camp, we are now working on a piped water system. We should have, of course, sewage addressed. Many people have been doing their own washrooms and toilets in their homes. So it's a bit unsafe as well. So it's one of the challenges is to get the sewage out of the camp.
One word on the lips of everybody I spoke to was winter. I finished up by asking Killian what it takes to prepare the camp for winter in the desert.
The camp needs to be able to deal with water. Last winter we had flooding here, so that needs to be addressed with better drainage, piping and so on. So we did a lot of work in spring. Then also now as we speak, there are more works underway. And then there's this whole question, of course, of how to support each family. Now, that means we have distributed plastic sheeting, which means we can cover some of the parts maybe leaking, which are not sort of impermeable anymore, such as tents, even these trailers, thermal blankets for the winter clothing, very important, the distribution is still ongoing. And then a key element will be gas heaters and gas fillings, which are expected to be distributed as of next week. Now, one of the other challenges we're having is that many of the people have put in electricity in their homes, even in their tents. And of course, because there are shops, and the shops are selling now electric heaters. So the problem is that the electricity system is collapsing because everybody is putting in 2,000 watt heaters. And so suddenly cables are burning and so on. Connections are very poorly done. So we would love to see these electric heaters switched off and put gas heaters on. So that will be a big challenge. And of course, with these electric cables, another challenge is that many of these wiring is done on the ground, and so you have live wires lying on the ground, and this is dangerous for children. So we would like to see them either in the dug in or being put up on poles in the air. So that's something I see, and I just returned from a tour in the camp. More and more people are actually digging in the wires. That's good news.
This list of challenges is unlikely to get shorter in the future. Yet, as you can hear from the sounds of trading on the shopping strip that's become known as the Champs-Élysées, the evidence that life goes on is there to be heard. The Somali famine of 2011 triggered a humanitarian response which saved thousands of lives. Whilst agencies worked hard to help those most in need, they faced difficult political circumstances. A new report released this month by ODI and the Mogadishu-based Heritage Institute for Policy Studies revealed for the first time the extent of the compromises that aid agencies were forced to make in order to provide help. Based on a series of interviews with members of Al-Shabaab and agency workers in Somalia at the time, the report, Talking to the Other Side, established that some agencies paid up to $10,000 to access areas of Somalia which were under the control of Al-Shabaab militia. These payments were the consequences of a significant ethical conundrum, not helped by the role of US and UK counter-terror legislation in dictating what actions agencies can take when it comes to negotiating with groups identified as terrorists. I spoke with the report's authors, Ashley Jackson of the Humanitarian Policy Group at ODI and Abdi Ayanti of HIPS in Somalia, to find out more about the reality of aid work in Somalia over the last few years. Ashley Jackson sets out the dilemma.
The famine affected predominantly areas under al-Shabaab control, and the dilemma for aid agencies was they were forced to make an impossible choice to choose between either staying and agreeing to al-Shabaab's demands, which included paying thousands of dollars in registration fees. It also included limiting their interactions with beneficiary populations, limiting the involvement of women, or they could withdraw. The famine ultimately killed over 250,000 people, so literally it was a life and death choice that they were making.
Many people knew al-Shabaab were making life difficult for aid agencies, but the systemic nature of their approach is best explained by Abdi Anti, who I spoke to over Skype from Mogadishu.
So al-Shabaab has an office called the Humanitarian Coordination's Office, and the main task of that structure was to try and prevent any threat emanating from international aid agencies, but at the same time to try and monetize their activities in the Shabaab-held territories in Salar and Somalia and central Somalia at the time. And so what the Humanitarian Coordination Agency of al-Shabaab done then was to create an elaborate process whereby aid agencies were forced to register and pay sometimes considerable sums of money to operate in Somalia, but then also to be subject to intrusive monitoring by this agency that a number of times actually recruited some of the beneficiaries of the aid agencies to try and monitor and report what they're doing. But at the same time, really try and monetize their activity, not only from the standpoint of registration, but aid agencies would be asked to pay for traveling from one location to the other, or trying to build a structure somewhere, or starting a new operation in a new place. So, it was both preventative, but as well as a mechanism designed to extract as much resources as possible.
So were the aid agencies prepared? Ashley Jackson says not.
What we found was that most aid agencies were remarkably ill-prepared to deal with al-Shabaab's efforts to extort from them and to co-opt their actions. We found few agencies had a structured approach or strategy to dealing with al-Shabaab. Those that did, however, managed more often than not to remain in the areas al-Shabaab was present, to often avoid paying fees, and to reach, populations affected by the famine.
So was preparation the main factor in determining which agencies fared better?
It was an extraordinarily difficult situation for aid agencies, and even those that were really well prepared faced impossible moral choices. But some agencies did manage to stay in al-Shabaab territory, and some of them provided medical services, which al-Shabaab was more receptive to, and that was one factor in enabling them to continue to help Somalis under al-Shabaab control. Another factor was long-term presence. For those agencies that remained, many had been there for decades, since the early 90s. So they had been around during a previous famine, the famine of 91-92. And there was a memory that they were there, that they helped, that they did good for Somalis. And that helped them out ultimately when the next famine rolled around in 2011.
And did paying money to al-Shabaab guarantee agencies access? Not so, according to Abdi.
It was not always the case, but it was an objective for the Humanitarian Coordination Office to extract as much money as possible from aid agencies, and oftentimes that equated greater access in the Shabaab-held territory. So while there was a causal effect between money and access, there was instances whereby some aid agencies were subjected to pay a considerably higher amount of money, but at the same time, the limitations that were put on them were quite pervasive and difficult because they were seen as higher profile, or they were strongly identified with a country or the other that the Shabaab saw as an enemy.
Despite this, according to Ashley, it was often Somalis themselves at the negotiating table.
What often happened was when al-Shabaab moved into a new area, took control of a town, they would move in to set up a civilian administration. They would approach aid agencies directly. So it was the aid workers on the ground in the villages and the towns of South Central Somalia that had the contact with al-Shabaab. And they would proceed to negotiate. Al-Shabaab wanted to know about the aid agencies, wanted information, wanted to know about the programs. So often all of this happened at a local level. And so it was Somalis themselves from those communities often negotiating with al-Shabaab.
So, ultimately, were those agencies that potentially broke the law justified in doing so?
Well, the most important thing here is that there was a basic supply and demand. There was a very incredible need, huge need for humanitarian aid to reach to thousands of people. 268,000 people have died in the famine of 2011. And many of them died because aid agencies were not able to get through them. And if they were able to get through them, many of them would have been saved. So, you know, the dilemma that aid agencies were facing was understandable. And many of them feared that they would be prosecuted in countries in the U.S., such as the U.S. and so on, for counterterrorism or for money laundering or whatnot. But the fact of the matter is that they were able to reach thousands and tens of thousands of people and saved a lot of others.
Corruption is a word which often comes up in association with aid and development. Corrupt practices amongst politicians and government workers often shoulder the brunt of a blame game which undermines efforts to build public support for continued aid and development spending. But how big a problem really is corruption? According to the experts, it is hard to know. Some say that corruption may not hurt overall economic performance as much as we might think. But given the effect it has on political processes, sweeping corruption under the carpet ignores a reality that has a very real and current effect on national development in parts of the world. A recent event held at the ODI looked specifically at the relationship between organised crime and democratic politics. Panelists set out to explore the role of so-called dirty money in squeezing out political space and corrupting political processes. I spoke to Marta Foresti, head of ODI's Politics and Governance Programme, and Catalina Uribe-Berca of International IDEA to try and find out more about how organised crime and politics interact in the world today. I began by asking Catalina to explain how dirty money enters the system.
Well, dirty money has entered the system through different shapes and forms. This idea that money comes in a bag, like a big boss is floating around during elections, is not really accurate, right? We've seen more organic and sustained relations over time. And as organized crime becomes more sophisticated and more interlinked with the legal economy, then it's easier for these linkages to take place more openly because it's not dirty money anymore. It's more legal money, apparently. Well, we've seen many examples of money being poured into elections. For example, I was earlier explaining the case in Bejo, where it is believed that money, especially in the form of in-kind contributions, has reached local campaigns. And that's mainly the case at local elections. So we see it in Colombia, we see it in Guatemala, we see it in Peru and Ecuador. So Latin America has had quite a big hit, but also in the Baltic states, we see not necessarily relations, but actually organized crime members becoming politicians. So we see it, for example, in some border regions. There is the city of Pagėgė, for example, in Lithuania, in the border with Russia, in the next to the Kaliningrad region, where it is believed that, for example, some mayors have also used their political power to support organized crime and vice versa. So it is really, in a way, not necessarily linkages being created, but actually people coming back and forth. It's like a rotating door between organized crime and politics.
Given the breadth of the problem, it seems surprising we don't hear more about the relationship between development and corruption. Marta explains why that is.
I think there are at least two reasons why these are not very common issues in development circles. The first is that these are not easy problems for aid to fix. They're just not the kind of things that aid traditionally deals with. The second, which goes at the heart of what we're trying to do today with the event at ODI, is that we actually don't know much about it. We don't know much about how these phenomena affect development. And that's one of the reasons why we don't hear much about it, because we actually don't know much about it.
And is corruption a one-size-fits-all term? Shouldn't we distinguish between different types of corruption?
There is no doubt that different types of corruption affect development outcomes in different ways. There are issues of volumes and sizes, but also purposes and how corruption can be very damaging by further reinforcing problems that exist. In other cases, the research shows that this can be done in a fairly developmental way. There is a lot of research on that and, of course, a lot of controversies around it. What I would say is that there is a tendency to focus on corruption as the symptoms. This kind of phenomena, so the illicit trades, organized crimes, are root causes of corruptions, are the kind of things that if you're serious about better understanding and reducing corruption we need to deal with. The problem at the moment is that a lot of the focus is on corruption per se and ways in which it can be stopped by being better controlled. This work suggests that there is a need to go beyond that and to look at what lies behind the phenomenon of corruption to understand better what the problems are, not just symptoms. Not an easy thing to do, but I think if we're serious about corruption, these are the kind of issue that we need to start dealing with.
So what does the kind of political corruption linked to organised crime look like in practice?
I don't want to be over simplistic here because it's not like a one unified structure, right? So there are many, many different drivers. It's mainly paralysing the state, so avoiding security services work so that they can easily move their goods. We saw it, for example, in Ecuador, in the city port of Manta, where there was a former governor who was found to have linkages with the Sinaloa and Cali cartels. And basically, he used his political power and his business power to make it harder for the security services to control the border and the port in that case. So it was easier to take drugs out from the port of Manta. As organized crime has become more sophisticated, many presumed businessmen have actually become having connections with organized crime. So it's harder in a way to control because by a large extent, it seems as though they are running a legal business.
So if the root of the problem is the ability of large sums of money to corrupt the democratic process, shouldn't we be equally concerned about the role of big business in politics? Not according to Marta.
I mean, there is no doubt that both of them, so dirty money and organised crime and big business, have the potential to affect negatively the political space and to hurt political voice. And they do share some features. This is about money buying out political space in different ways. I would say that the main difference is that at the moment, in the international community and in development thinking, there is actually quite a lot of attention on big businesses. And following the G8, for example, a quite clear determination to go after some of those practices, for example, on tax havens and other tax-related issues. The problem with organised crime, as I said at the beginning, is that we don't know much about it, so we literally don't know who we're dealing with. So I would say that there is more to be done there, and there's no doubt it is harder because of some of the key features of the phenomenon.
So what can we do about this? According to Catalina, the answer may be to spread accountability for corruption from individuals to parties.
We've seen very interesting methods and tools developed in different countries, and we need to learn from those. For example, in Colombia, there have been very interesting, innovative rules, for example, to make parties accountable, not just the politician. So in a way, they are risking to lose seats in the parliament, the party itself, or even being closed, the parties. And they are discussing inter-party agreements as well, in a way that the candidates don't threaten parties that they're going to run then to another party with those votes and that money they have if that party doesn't endorse them. So these types of mechanisms that have been even developed in some of the countries that have more issues can be learned and shared among other countries that are facing similar issues or facing transition to democracies and thus a bigger risk of potential penetration from organized crime.
But for Marta, there are bigger solutions to be found, including the potential reform of drug laws.
I mean, I certainly agree that I think the time has come to take these alternative routes and these alternatives and some would say radical policy positions more seriously. It's not as if it's not happening. I think it's news of today that Uruguay is legalizing marijuana precisely with the name to stamp down organized crime. And so I think there is definitely scope to look into those solutions. It's also very clear that this is not that aid or the development community can lead on. These are fundamentally politically difficult decisions, but those which I think need to be looked into.
With an increasing number of internationally respected voices speaking out about drug law reform, the relationship between development and illegal drugs can expect further scrutiny. Thank you for listening to the ODI Monthly Podcast. If you want more information on the topics discussed in this month's podcast, you can take a look at the related links section of the ODI podcast webpage. If you want to get in touch, drop us a line on media@odi.org.uk. If you've enjoyed listening, why not subscribe to the monthly podcast using iTunes or Audioboo? Thanks for listening.